Are you going to be brave enough to do a chat in classes just on, like, deep analysis of Colonel Abrams?
I would like to. I'm still working on my thesis.
or Coolio?
Coolio. What
1, 2, 3, 4 something new meant to you?
Well, hello everyone. It's episode 41 of the Chattering Classes, and I'm joined by Mr. Stuart Buckland. How are you, Buckland?
I'm good. I do have a question straight off the bat.
Oh, all right. Rock on.
Does this follow? This episode follows straight on from the episode with your two mates chatting about teaching and David Foster Wallace and so on. Is this the next one along?
Yeah, that's the next one. Yeah. Okay.
So we're following up that intellectual chat with me. Is that what's happening?
I like to give the audience a balance, you know, give them a rest. If someone's like binge listening, like they're going to have
I'm
to
happy
follow.
To talk about David Foster.
Woodchopper extraordinaire.
We've already had
I am more than happy to talk about David Foster. And if you don't know who David Foster is, go to YouTube right now, type in David Foster woodchopping and just be amazed because... I don't say that lightly. David Foster is the world's greatest woodchopper of all time.
Yeah.
Would you agree?
Yeah, I would. Well, not that I've stacked him up against too many other people, but there's something just very primitive about seeing a big, hairy ape go nuts on a piece of wood.
Yeah, and he's a huge man too. It's violent, but there's something... just amazing about it. Beautiful to watch.
All right. So what are we talking about today? My favorite Anna Nicole Smith movies?
Now.
Top five?
All right. We've got Wiggins listening, that's for sure. Top five. Can you... All right. Here we go.
How many
can you name?
Damn it.
I got three, I think. I got two. I got two, unless you...
Well, there's Naked Gun 33 and a third. We know that.
Yeah, got that one, yeah.
Skyscraper? Wasn't there one called Skyscraper?
That's right, yep.
And To the Limit.
To the Limit! Yeah, there you go.
I'm quickly thinking back to our friend Wiggins' VCR
video
collection.
Yeah, exactly right. Anyway, well, let's get off into Nicole Smith. We've done that. We've covered that. I want to talk to you. You're a big Beatles fan as well, and there's probably going to be several episodes in this series that will cover the Beatles in their regard.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to talk to you about Ringo because I want to get your opinion on Ringo as a drummer and the idea. And if I asked you which of the four Beatles would be the easiest to replace, would your answer be Ringo? Or who would be missed the least if they were replaced?
Four.
I know. And I think that question really shows like what kind of a band they were.
Yeah.
Is that...
I guess the easy answer is Ringo because... he wasn't a part of it for a significant portion of their career, and lots of recordings of them pre-1962 without him in there, and it's all fairly standard rock and roll drumming, you would suggest.
That's true.
Pete Best, he had... He had one kind of beat, which he stuck to with pretty much everything that he played, right? I can't really remember hearing too much variation in his stuff.
No.
The thing about replacing Ringo, I guess, is that he's... While people argue about whether he was a good drummer or not, more to the point is that he's a very idiosyncratic drummer.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that it...
Hard to replicate, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's had a way or a habit of fitting well whatever was being thrown at him from the songwriters.
Yeah, and this is something that I don't think I've read much about or heard much about. There's constant stories that we hear about, you know, that Paul and John used to sit together and write songs, eyeball to eyeball or whatever Paul always says, and write songs together, and that George would write these songs later and get better and better. But there's not really much that I've read about Ringo of what they actually had to say to him. We're doing this kind of song and we want you to... Because they're not musicians and they go do this thing and do... So that's one thing that he doesn't get credit for, or maybe it's just never really spoken about, is how did they go, for this song we want this kind of beat and for this song we want this kind of beat? And it was like, yeah, sure.
But you can, because in the anthologies or wherever you've heard snippets of studio chat, they're chatting with each other about how they're playing guitars and so on. But there's never, like you say, there's never any direct chat to Ringo. And you'd imagine if there was a lot of that, then it'd be picked up by chance somewhere along the line.
Yeah, it's weird. Never any chat. I mean, a lot of it is obviously kept in house, but there was never any stuff about Ringo wasn't getting it or that Ring. But it's not even. And then Ringo brought this idea to us. Did they just go, "Hey, Ringo, we need this," and he went, "All right," and just did it?
I just think, really, like he, despite the fact that, like we said, his drumming's pretty idiosyncratic and fits well with a lot of the music. I honestly think they just got him in at the start because they liked him better as a personality wise, and
without a doubt,
and he had the same kind of banter that the rest of them had, and that's very obvious in their early press and early touring when they get stuck in front of the media. But the very strong sense I get from probably, like, I don't know, the end of touring definitely, but maybe even mid 65 onwards, is that it was kind of like an office job for him.
Yeah.
In that he'd turn up, do his drum parts, kind of sit around for a while to see if he was needed.
Yeah. I think he says, like, Sergeant Pepper's, I think it's in the anthology, he says, oh, when they recorded Sergeant Pepper's, that's where he learned how to play chess.
Yes.
There's a whole lot of him, I think that's exactly right, sitting around. I think they were like, all right, Ringo, can you do this?
Yeah.
And he went, blah, blah, blah. And they went, now, can you make it more like da-da-da-da-da-da or whatever? And he went, okay. And then they go, all right, cool. And then he'd sit around for another 6 days while they added trombones. And
exactly. Well, there's all that production side of it, but also just in the creative side of it. I'm sure he was just kind of off to the side. And I guess the big question is, was he happy to be off to the side, or did he actively try and get involved in a lot of that and just kind of get face palmed out to the side?
I mean, because I'd say if he tried to get in, I reckon, like, I think his sensibility was like, all right, I'll just sit over here, because he would have been seeing George, especially early on, get that face palm. Like, I've written this song, whatever, George. And
I don't think he was particularly
not bothered.
Bothered or particularly creative or ambitious about that kind of thing. I just think he was happy just to kind of sit around and do what he needed to do and have fun and go home.
Yeah, you know, that's right. Yeah, I think that, like you said, the fact that he enjoyed the same banter, the same, like, sense of humour, would have meant it's not like sitting like that. It's not quite an office job because you're not sitting around with people that you don't get along with or that you don't like.
Yeah.
But I think, like you said, especially towards the end of it, 68 onwards, there would have been a lot of times where he was like, what the fuck am I doing here?
Well, what about in Let It Be when, you know, there's one bit where George is helping him with Octopus's Garden.
Yeah.
And the rest of the time, what's Ringo doing?
Yeah, that's right. He's got one song in 3 years or 4 years or something, and they're like, all right, just, how you going, Ringo? Cup of tea?
Yeah. When you first said it, I didn't want to say Ringo was the most easily replaceable. So, but I'm going through the others, like George would probably be your next pick, but what people what people, like, because he's quiet and so on, people might go, well, he could probably be replaced by, I don't know, Eric Clapton or whatever, you know, Jeff Beck. But what, particularly early years, what he provided was that bit of the harmony that blends everything together really nicely.
Yeah, so, that's the thing especially when you listen to it with headphones, obviously, it's just like, you're like, oh God, how to just fit everything so well together. And I think, you know, I think Paul was really good at organizing those, but to actually have that, yeah, you're probably right there. But he also, with his guitar, I think, and I could be wrong, it's either Day Tripper. There's an isolated track which is just George's guitar work, which you can't hear what he's doing throughout the song because there's so much other stuff happening in the song.
Yeah.
But when it's an isolated track, you're like, oh, he's just like provides the bass line for everyone else to go off. He's just he just drives
is it I Feel
every
Fine?
Song.
You're talking
about? Maybe it's I Feel Fine,
Right.
And he just drives the song. You're like, oh, right, he's just playing, everyone play off this. I'm just going to play this bit here. I'm going to mix it up a little bit, but everyone just play off me, and then I'll bring it back.
Yeah.
And that's really obvious.
Yeah. Oh, I honestly think that's probably part of their overall success, which isn't as easily quantifiable, is just how well everyone's bits meshed together. I tried not to make that sound dirty, but it did in the end. But, like, you know, everyone's qualities kind of linked in just the right areas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, even the
fact that, as discussed, Ringo was so laid back and happy to let everyone else do everything. I mean, that worked well in a band when with the two big egos of Paul and John. Like, imagine, like, George had a half go, but imagine if all four of them were kind of all vying for songwriting supremacy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing too, that George really came into his own as the other two weren't becoming less writers, but were probably getting a bit sick of putting up the fight. I think there was a bit more leeway, and George is coming in with better stuff that they're like, oh, all right, that's all right.
That's right. But I think it's also like when by the time George is doing more and more songs and better songs is when they're getting more into the arty psychedelic era, and they're off to avant-garde art shows and doing film scores and making kind of underground
producing movies
and stuff like that. So, their attention, well, Paul's particularly, but John's to some degree as well, wasn't 100% just on pumping out Beatles songs, you know.
So that's right. But don't you think it's weird, especially George as a songwriter, is that his two great songs on Abbey Road, which is Something and Here Comes the Sun, like they're like stolen, not stolen, they're like borrowed lyrics or something like that. Like Something is just taken from James Taylor, Something in the Way She Moves. That's the opening line to his song. And then I remember my brain like breaking when I found out they did Sun King before Here Comes the Sun.
All right.
I don't. You just assume that Here Comes the Sun happened and he wrote that, and then they went, well, let's do Here Comes the Sun King, okay, and do it separately. But they did that first, and then he's like, I've got a great idea for a song. It's called Here Comes the Sun. And it's obviously, like, they're both great songs, but they're just, it's so weird that he's just. And then he's like, I think he didn't Apple produce James Taylor, and James Taylor singing Something in the Way She Moves.
Yeah.
He's the opening line. And he goes, that's good. Yeah. That's a good line.
Yeah.
And then goes off and writes Something. And I've heard an interview with James Taylor, and they're like, oh, did that bum you out? And he's like, no. So there's a songwriter's joke, which is like, I liked your song so much that I went home and wrote it.
Like I think there was a lot more of that in those days, and it wasn't really. people weren't litigious, like, for a start.
No,
but
not at
also
all.
Like people were happy to let people just take snippets of things.
Yeah, of course.
And then I think by the 70s, Led Zeppelin ruined it by ripping off
many
people, like just going mental. And then after that. But I think in the last episode, someone was talking about Sour Milk Sea, which is a phenomenal song. And I like George's demo of it better than the produced song that he ended up doing. But that demo is just great. I love it so much. Goodbye. Oh, sorry. Good night. Onto the White Album.
Yeah.
Savoy Truffle found. Mm-hmm. Why did they do Savoy Truffle?
Yeah, and
instead
not
Sour Milk Sea.
It is an odd choice, isn't it? That just freaks you out, isn't it?
Can I just sing you a list of chocolates? Is that all right? Let's put that on the album.
Yeah, I'll just go to a restaurant and steal their menu and just read it out to you. It's fair enough.
Well,
John got a poster and did, you know, benefit of being Mr. Kai, and I was just why can't I just do the same? Yeah, you're right. It's an odd.
I don't like, but that's one of my lesser liked songs, Mr. Kai, I have to say.
Yeah, I find the more I listen to the album, Sgt. Pepper's there's a lot of filler in that album. It's all beautiful, amazing production. It's a great leap forward in music production and what you can achieve. But I listen to like Lovely Rita and Good Morning and even to some extent like Fixing a Hole, which is an interesting idea. There's a lot of just, okay. Like it's a step back from
Revolver.
Like Revolver's their peak
of
songwriting production, I think.
Yeah, I think so much of Sgt. Pepper was like periphery stuff to the music. The fact that it was, you know, a concept album in quotation marks, just the fact that it was released at just that Summer of Love moment. Yeah. The sequencing's quite good, like as in when they chose to have which song followed which song kind of thing. It's really good sequencing. So I think a lot of that is kind of does distract slightly from the fact that, there's a little bit of piffle in there.
Oh, great. I'm just going to steal that. But I do remember, like, when I got into the Beatles at, like, 16, 17, like, Sgt. Pepper's was the album to listen to loud and get every little bit of sound and just be amazed at what they were doing.
I remember coming to your house and we just stuck White Album on straight away and just sat around listening to it, not really talking that much. Do you remember that?
Not really. That's the role reversal of our usual conversations. But
I know. You forget something I remember. I do because I think I'd only heard bits of the White Album before that. I hadn't actually sat down and listened through to the whole thing, and we sat there. We certainly listened to side one all the way through, and I think maybe side two later, but
okay.
It was the first time I'd listened to it as an album.
Right. And just actually sat there and just listened.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
I just wanted to, maybe we can just delve into this quickly, is all the revelations that have come out, certainly in Hollywood, in America, in the entertainment industry, in Australia as well, does some of it affect how you view some of the people involved, view their work, or can you watch it without having to, you know, process the information? And I'm looking at a comparison between, say, like Bill Cosby and Louis C.K. So, like, Bill Cosby, you know, his career and his legacy is now more than likely just going to turn to dust. Would you agree?
Yes.
Okay. Like, people who influenced him, nearly every comedian who's successful will... you'll be able to find something online of them talking about how Bill Cosby was his inspiration and how they loved him. Not anymore. No one's really going to bring that up. But what about Louis C.K.? Do you think the allegations against him, do they affect you personally in the same way?
Well, purely for me, it's just that you can't help but think of it if you're watching something of his. I mean, I haven't tried to watch anything of his since the news came out, just because, yeah. I don't know, I haven't. Not because it's been an active decision, but I guess I just don't get how I'll be able to watch it and not think about him in the corner leering at somebody while he's
touching himself.
Yeah, it can't really be divorced. Now, is that to say that his comedy's bad, should it be viewed differently now? Well, it does make you wonder, because he said some pretty out there stuff, and it does put a bit of a hint on it now. Is going, oh, is this really that creative, or is it close to home? Some of it.
Just talking about his actual life, not just creating these scenarios. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, but look, I mean, it's degrees. It's everything in life is degrees. You can't put what Cosby did in the same basket, really, can you? I mean, if that's the case, then you are saying that do anything wrong that makes somebody... like that harasses somebody or makes them feel bad once is the same as a lifetime of sexual assault. Let's not.
Sexual assault. Yeah, deviant sexual assault. Yeah, that's true. And I think
I really hope that. Sorry, I really hope that doesn't come across as defending in any way, because it's not. I'm just. Just logical to not have be that black and white about everything.
Yeah, you can't have the equivalency across the board of every story. As much as I think news outlets want it to be as simple as that. Look at this horrible story that happened, and we'll equate this as much as possible. I just think, and this is again, it's all personal, and I think it's always personal. I think that that's also an issue that we have. It's certainly online, but, you know, why would you try and monitor arguments online about art and intent? But what tends to be happening is that, you know, people like to say it's either a yes, it's fine and get over it, or no, nothing, we should never talk about it ever again, and everything he's ever done is despicable. There's got to, it's down to personal. People can justify any behavior within themselves. They're putting the same impact on other people as well.
Yes. Yeah, that's completely true. But I think just it's not a question of choice as a viewer. It's not a question of choice going, well, I can't possibly view this in the same light anymore. There's no choice to you. Because you have the information and it's in your mind, you're going to be thinking of it when you watch his stuff, and it's going to affect it. It's not a choice.
Yeah, that's that's completely true. I found that I've watched a few things, like old clips of him that I used to watch, you know, from time to time. I'm really bummed on a very selfish level, because I used to use so many Louis C.K. clips in class, because he deconstructs things really well. And when you're teaching deconstruction or anything like breaking an idea apart, comedians are really good at a really good example of how to do that. And it's kind of, well, I can't show this anymore. Can't show that anymore.
How good are your video editing skills? Can you put someone else's head on?
I could just steal his material. Like, hey, you know what? Here's some deconstruction I came up with, and just rehash his whole material. Hopefully,
just put Bob Saget's head on Louis C.K.'s body.
Yeah.
Get his mouth to move in time.
Well, what if
those kids aren't going to know that that's Louis C.K.'s voice?
What if people go, "Oh, I like that Bob Saget. I looked up Bob Saget Aristocrats and saw what
in he the Aristocrats." Yeah, I know.
So what he had to
I was
say
crawling
that.
Around. I was crawling around for a clean comedian, and Bob Saget came out, and then almost immediately I thought of the Aristocrats.
Yeah, well, you could put Bob Saget from Full House on there anyway.
I thought of the Aristocats, which is a great animated film. But anyway,
I don't think I've ever seen that. But anyway, yeah. So that was the thing, because I was just thinking about it today, and I thought, I think I will still watch Louis C.K.'s stuff. Yeah, exactly right. I'll always think of that in the back of my mind. And if I've watched a clip recently on YouTube, which I haven't very much, but if I do, I always go down just to see what the first comment is. And it's, 100% like either everyone needs to get over the fact that he pulled his dick out and whacked off in front of people, like that's what everyone has to get over, or it's like, it's like, how dare you be offended by that, or it's, this video should be taken down and all his stuff should be taken off the internet. There's no in between. The internet isn't a place for grey areas at all.
No. And obviously, again, it'll, like, what happens in the future, does he make a comeback, is all down to how deftly he plays it. But he doesn't, I don't know how much of an apologetic kind of person he is or can be.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like, his apology was kind of not the greatest one I've ever seen. And And I don't know, what do you think he's going to do, lay low for a few years and then his head up and see what happens? Or?
See, this is what I think is his major dilemma with making any kind of comeback, especially soon, is I think the people who would go and see him as, like, in his defense, I don't know if he wants them as his fans.
Yes. A lot of his comedian friends are also very, like, it took them a little while to kind of say something about it.
Yeah.
And when they did, it was all very gingerly, as in, we're not going to go in too hard on him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Sarah Silverman, Mark Maron, and like, it was all kind of very gently in addressing the issue.
Yeah, but I mean, that's understandable, isn't it? I think, again, people were like, oh, no, that was too... You need to be harder on him and never be friends with him. Like, it's that kind of thing. So how do you go... How do you address that with someone who you're
as
friends
a friend.
With or as someone who's a really close friend? You can't just all go, right. Oh, they're disgusting. I'm done with them. I mean, you can do that. You can do that easily. People will do that without a doubt. But it's that question of, okay... You got to separate.
Well, if you're a friend, though, wouldn't you see it as an issue they have potentially?
Yeah, well, definitely. But you'd also have to look
that
at
that they may need help with.
Yeah, exactly right. But you'd also, if you wanted to be cynical, would be looking at how do you position yourself around it so you don't cop any of the heat that he is.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Do you mean publicly?
Yeah, because if you're in the public eye, people are demanding a public apology. You don't want to go up there and... If you go out and support him and say no, like privately, you might be supportive and be... But I think he would have an understanding of that too. You know what
but
I mean?
Again,
I reckon the reason
it
took
to
people
how...
to be... Yeah.
Sorry, it comes down to how he plays it. There's no good you coming up there and going... Look, what he did was wrong, but I'm going to support him because he's my friend and clearly he has some issues to work through. If he's going to come out and go, no, I don't, there's nothing wrong with me.
Yeah.
You know, and he's really
that's true.
Kind
that's...
of belligerent about it.
Yeah. Imagine if he came out and made that statement in the exact snap tone. I'd be like, all right, okay.
When I imagined that in my head, I imagined like, let's say, for argument's sake, Bill Burr on Louis C.K.'s front doorstep talking to a press gang.
Yeah.
And then the door opening and Louis C.K. sticking his head out going, nah, bullshit. I don't have any issues. I just felt like doing it, so I did it.
He's eating like a chicken leg or something like that. Just as casual as possible, cavalier as possible about it all. Oh,
that's
dear.
Right. And then his hands go south. I'll do it. No.
Back in. Bill, he picks up back a broom and pushes him back inside. Get back in there.
Yeah. That's all I was saying.
Well, that was a good, that's a nice way to wrap up that serious conversation with a very arresting
image. I don't
image.
Think we achieved anything in terms
no,
of...
No, no. I didn't think we would. I don't think we're... I was just interested in the thought that popped into my head today, and I thought, I wonder what Buckland has to say about it. And now we know.
Well, on that topic, just briefly, I know you want to move on.
Yeah.
But there's kind of been a little Craig McLaughlin support base coming out saying, like, apart from the fact, did you know this, that he's counter-suing the female cast members of Rocky Horror who came
right,
out and accused
no.
him. He's counter-suing them for indecent behaviour.
Okay, yep. So they slandered his good name, yep.
Well, no, that they've done stuff to him as well.
Oh,
is what he's
right.
Saying.
Okay. Yeah.
And then there's this support group, like, not support group, but various people coming out saying, well, look, it's a sexual show.
Yeah.
He's playing a character. He's in character. So sexual stuff was going to happen.
Okay.
You know what I mean? So
it's method. It's just method.
Well, that's what, in a roundabout way, that seems to be what they're trying to say. It just seems really odd that, like, a month has passed before someone, it seems like someone came up with a good enough excuse to come out with and go, oh, hang on. I know it's a month later, but I've thought about this, and here's what I think's why it happened.
Yeah. They've maybe spent a month, like, reading, like, the method, Lee Strasberg, like, if you're playing a sexual character, just walk around touching people inappropriately. Just just be like that all the time. The audience will believe you more.
That's it, because you... Frankenfurter's a deep character you really need to get inside of.
There's so many layers. There's layers to it, without a doubt.
Yeah.
Just, and you can explore that by, you know... Just putting it about. Anyway, sorry. What I wanted to talk about as well, a theme that I like to go on about here is parenting. I like talking about how you go as a parent. And I wanted to talk to you specifically because when you met your lovely wife, she already had a child, correct?
Yeah.
Yep. And how old was he when you two met or started going out?
Two.
And did you know immediately, like, that was one, like, straight
or just
away,
before two, maybe?
Just before two.
Yeah, maybe just
and did
before
you,
two.
And you knew, obviously, when the relationship started that she had a kid. And did that, was there any, like future thinking about that for you? Or were you just like, oh, let's see how this goes, or?
Well, not exactly. Like, when I met Michelle, being in a relationship was the furthest thing that I wanted to do.
Okay.
because I just come out of a relationship which ended poorly. and I was not feeling very good about things. And I'd been in and out of relationships for all of my 20s. And I was hitting 30 and had another one fail. And because I just kind of floated from relationship to relationship really without thinking through my 20s about...
It's pretty standard 20s behavior, isn't it?
It is, but even just not even a cursory, do I even want to be in a relationship? Not even a cursory thing. It's just like it was really just a floaty, floating from here to there kind of deal. And so after that last one ended, I'd finally decided to think about what I was doing and go, well, I don't really want to be in a relationship. And then Michelle came up right at that point. So I chatted to her a lot and we got on and had great conversations, but I was actively trying not to make it a relationship at the start, but that kind of frustrated her a bit and she backed off a bit and then I found that I was missing her. So we got back to together and chatted again, and then it all went from there. Long-winded way of answering your question about how much thought went into the fact that she had a child. It was just a kind of process. I was going into it not thinking about the fact that I may end up raising this child.
Yeah.
Michelle and I were just enjoying each other and getting to know each other, and I was getting to know Owen as well, and it just all kind of grew from there. There wasn't, again, contradictory, I know, because I said I wouldn't do it, but there wasn't a lot of thought put into it. It just kind of felt like it was cool. So
yeah, I guess it's something that just happens, isn't it? If you're not overthinking it, I guess.
No. And I mean, no one... I think it's safe to say no one kind of grows up preparing themselves to be a step-parent. Going, I wonder, I'm looking forward to the day that I, get to meet my partner's child. It's something that you kind of have to abruptly deal with when it happens, because...
That is very true, isn't it? No one ever goes, when I grow up, I hope I'm a really good step-parent.
No. Yeah, so...
All right.
I'm pretty proud of how I dealt with that on the fly, because, as mentioned, I wasn't proud of how I dealt with things in my 20s a lot. So, I don't regret it for a second, obviously. I couldn't be happier.
Would you say, talking about how you floated through relationships and in your 20s sort of bouncing around, it's similar to like when I spoke to Wiggins about, the fact that he had a kid when he was 23, and I could be wrong there, but around that age. Do you think it was like a real marker of you, like, for want of a better phrase, becoming an adult?
Was that a marker?
Yeah, when you look back at it, like there's some pride there that, all right, this happened and it could have been tricky.
Oh, right.
I handled it in a mature way, because a lot of like your 20s, especially things that in my 20s I look back on and I think that it was not a mature way to handle that situation in any way, shape or form, especially emotionally. There was very little emotional maturity in my 20s.
I think the timing of everything happening was just right, because that last relationship I was talking about that ended badly before I met Michelle, well, it was really the first time I'd had my heart broken. And that was kind of at the age of 30. Like, for the rest of the relationships, I had all kind of petered out, I guess, without any kind of... but, yeah, that one was a big shock to the system. And so I think it kind of snapped me out of the kind of dreamy haze of my 20s almost.
Right, like, oh, so, well, you just have relationships and then they peter out. No one really gets that hurt. They sort of drift away and then you just... And then you find someone else and you try that out and then it's just, oh, well, that didn't work so well. And then, yeah, that happens in your late 20s.
That was my whole 20, not just relationships, everything, like, friendships, career, hobbies, anything. It was just kind of flittering from here to there without much commitment to anything. And so that happening kind of, it put a full stop on my 20s, basically. And kind of that and the fact that I was turning 30 really made me go, holy shit, what the fuck am I doing? What am I doing with my life? And that's when I kind of, started thinking about what I was doing in my career properly for the first time. And started trying to look after myself a little better.
What did that involve? Or what weren't you looking after yourself about? Is this like in regards to like drinking, or is this just in everything in regard to everything? Diet, exercise,
drinking, diet, other stuff as well.
Yeah,
came with working in pubs sometimes. But it's more just the philosophy of going from not caring to maybe I should care.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
You go on.
No, that's it. It was just, it's the timing of relationship breaking down, hitting 30, and, not long after that, Michelle coming along was all kind of what... spurred me from being apathetic Buckland in the 20s to the corporate high flyer you're speaking to now.
The corporate Buckland we know and love. Now, this just occurred to me. So have you ever spoken to your parents about what they were seeing of you in your 20s?
I missed a lot of that, sorry. It kind of dropped out for a second.
Oh, sorry. So have you spoken to your parents about what they saw in you in your 20s or saw
Oh, right. No, because no, I think they were just generally... When I was a kid, I was very kind of headstrong. Yeah. And if we got into any kind of big blow up about anything, I would just run away. I ran away like 3 times. And so one time
what age was this happening?
28. no, like preteen.
Okay, yeah.
But I think like my parents always had a very, like, a worry about if they upset me too much that I would just disappear.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which is, it's kind of not particularly fair to judge someone in their 20s on what they used to do when they were 10 and got yelled at.
Yeah, but I find my parents still judge me. When I go home, I feel like I'm 18. They go back into... whatever you were like when you left the house. That's how I seem to read it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
right. Yeah.
So they were just like, all right, don't upset him.
I'm sure they were worried, but they never brought much up to my face. It would usually just be if I smell like cigarettes or something, they would have a go at me about, well, what are you doing? smoking, drinking, what are you, like that kind of thing, but no actual direct questioning of my life or goals. I remember you questioning my life and goals once.
This is like two times where you're remembering something from our past that I can't remember. This is amazing. This is freaking me out.
You might remember.
Okay.
You might remember. It was the night at Wiggo's at East Gosford where we were drinking was it black or white Russians? I think white Russians.
Okay.
Or black Russians.
Like the really wasted, like the night? Are we talking about? Are we talking about the night?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And we all went down the waterfront.
So this is something you remember from that night? I don't have much. This sorry for everyone listening. There was just an evening that happened around 2007, still referred to as the night, just insanity, massive amounts of alcohol. I don't remember anything from about 1 a.m., but anyway.
Well, I remember this bit because it struck me as...
Jesus.
Struck me as particularly comic.
Okay.
So we all walked down to the waterfront at Gosford.
Yeah.
And everyone was just kind of sitting around and chatting and being loud and obnoxious.
I'm just so excited to hear what this is. I'm really excited because, all right. I have no idea.
And I felt very unwell.
Okay.
So I decided to get up and wander off by myself so I could start chundering and not disturb people too much.
Okay.
Which I did.
Yeah. Yep. Well,
and
I remember finding you.
I let a decent gutful go, and I kind of, when I sat back and, you know, tried to do that calming down breathing, you do go, and you were sitting there near me, and you'd obviously decided this was primo time for a D&M.
Jesus.
Because you just sat there and went, you just looked at me and you said, "What's the plan, man? What's the plan?"
Far out.
Because you clearly didn't know what I was doing with my life, and I think you must have had a moment of kind of going, "What is he doing? Does he know what he's doing? Does he have something he's working towards?" And you very earnestly asked me at that moment what my plan was, and I'm leaning over there, just kind of, I'm gasping for breath over a puddle of my own spew.
Yeah, and I might add that I've never...
I suppose it was probably a good time to ask what the hell I was doing.
I know, but it's, I don't know where, I guess that's the moment of clarity people talk about, but I have, that is hilarious. What a fucked up thing to ask someone who's spewing up their guts at their lowest point of the evening.
Well, it struck me as, I think the reason I remember it is because it struck me as extremely funny timing to be asking someone what their long-term plans are.
Wow.
And also, like, it did hit me as, oh, fuck, I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, so...
Yeah, I know, but that's a pretty cruel time. No, if you ask someone when they're vomiting, no matter how successful their life is, what's your plan, they're not going to be any kind of like positive frame of mind to deal with that question.
I'm not going to hold against you your ability to pick the right moment after quite a lot of white Russians.
Oh, my God. That's awesome. Far out. Okay.
But, yes. To answer your question, you asked me more questions about my life direction than what
Right. Yeah. I don't know why I felt that was my duty. I don't know why I felt like that was my duty. I fucking had an intervention with Wiggins when he was whatever, however old he was. I just felt it was my duty to sort your life out.
Well, you weren't offering any plans or solutions. You were just offering questions.
That's even worse. Like, here's a question for you to dwell on for the next 10 years of your life.
That's right.
See ya. I'm going back to the fun.
It didn't take that long, thankfully, but yeah.
Wow, okay. That is excellent. Excellent work. You know what? I think we might end it there. We might finish on that note because I think I've asked you enough questions.
No, that's okay. You have no more parenting.
No more parenting
questions.
No? Not really, no. That was always my thought. I don't think I'd ever asked you was, you know, this how you go about from having no child to having a stepchild. You know what I mean? Like, it's not usually you're with someone and they have a child and away you go. That's the standard procedure. And then this time was like, I don't know, child. Yeah. You have child.
I guess
now.
If you have to think about it,
yeah,
then you probably shouldn't do it.
No, that's a very good point.
Yeah. I know that there wasn't really much thought. It just, this happened, and then it led to the next day, and then it led to the next day, and then here we are. Yeah.
Nice. I think that's it.
If you're traveling in the North Country Fire, where the winds hit heavy on the borderline, remember me to one who lives there. For she once was a true lover man. She once was a true love of mine.